I remember Father Webb once telling me that when the Campbelltown, or is it Kintar, Antiquarian Society was founded, they went 7 years before they invited an outside speaker to address them. Well, we have no such record behind us, but I think Hugh has more or less addressed us for the last 7 years, and it's obvious that you think him good value for money, because look at you. Hugh is going to address us on St. Malachy. I don't know, I'm sorry, I'm an ignoramus. I don't know anything about him, and I'm looking forward to this immensely. Hugh, will you? Please.
Well, thank you all, ladies and gentlemen, very much for your kind welcome. It's a great pleasure to be here tonight. If you want to know how many times I have addressed this association, if my diaries are telling the truth, it's the sixth time. Some words by way of introduction to our theme tonight. Although this is by no means the first occasion on which it has been my privilege to speak to the members of the Glens of Antrim Historical Society, I feel particularly privileged to speak to you tonight. I say this because this is a week which began with the first Irishman to be declared a saint for more than seven centuries. That model of reconciliation, as Pope Paul rightly described Oliver Plunkett. The previous one to be canonized was he of whom I hope to speak tonight, St. Malachy of Armagh, Abbot of Bangor. You will agree, I hope, that it is not altogether inappropriate that our theme tonight should be St. Malachy, because earlier this year we were all greatly honoured to have in this same room a lecture on Blessed Oliver Plunkett, as he was then designated, by the Reverend Dr. Thomas Fee, President of St. Patrick's College, Maynooth. Dr. Fee was one of the radio commentators at the canonization ceremony in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome last Sunday morning, a ceremony which I followed very closely on the radio, and not least that part of it where the second lesson was read by a clerical student of the Diocese of Down and Connor, Mr. Donald McCone, thereby anchoring, as it were, or at least associating both St. Malachy and Oliver Plunkett with this diocese. Now, I deliberately refer to this before beginning my lecture and make no apology whatever for doing so, even at some length, for a very special reason. And the reason is this. Dr. Fee's lecture here earlier this year was so very interesting, informative, and instructive that it provided me with the impulse to attempt the story of the life and work of Oliver Plunkett, St. Oliver Plunkett's predecessor in the annals of Irish canonization, St. Malachy of Armagh, Abbot of Bangor. Thank you. The reason is this: Dr. Fee's lecture here earlier this year, as I have said, was so very interesting, informative and instructive that it provided me with the impulse to attempt the story of the life and work of St. Monica, or of Oliver Plunkett's predecessor in the annals of Irish canonization, St. Monica of Armagh, Abbot of Bangor. After all, in the important realm of higher education, is not the first recorded monastic, and I emphasize the word monastic, Bishop of Connor, Angus MacNeice, now commemorated by St. MacNeice's College at Yarran Tower? And is not Monica the first diocesan Bishop of Connor, commemorated by St. Monica's College in the city of Belfast? The life and work of St. Monica of Armagh, Abbot of Bangor, has always greatly fascinated me down the years. And that, very simply, ladies and gentlemen, explains why I stand before you tonight to attempt, however inadequately, some estimate of this great medieval Irish ecclesiastic. St. Monica of Armagh, Abbot of Bangor. St. Monica of Armagh, Abbot of Bangor and Bishop of Connor from 1124 to 1134, Archbishop, or strictly speaking, High Bishop of Armagh. I will explain why I use the term High Bishop later on in the course of the lecture. Archbishop, or strictly speaking, High Bishop of Armagh from 1134 to 1137, and Bishop of Down, which then included the present Diocese of Dromore, from 1137 to 1148, and a native of the primatial city, was born in 1095. 1095 was an eventful year, inasmuch as the Holy Father, Urban II, summoned a council at Clermont in France, and there the Holy Father, in moving words, besought the chivalry of Europe to set aside its private feuds, and I will recover the holy places from the hands of the infidel, or die before the holy city where Christ himself had given his life for the world. Such was the Pope's lead in what was destined to be the first, and as it happened, the most successful of the various crusades. At the time of Monica's birth, the English monarch was William II, son of the Conqueror. Not until the reign of the Conqueror's great-grandson, Henry II, did that monarch assume the title Lord of Ireland. And four centuries were to pass before that beast, as the Irish wit and satirist Jonathan Swift, Dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin, described Henry VIII, before that beast, Henry VIII, exchanged the title Lord of Ireland for that of King of Ireland. Monica's father, who died at Mungret in what is now County Limerick on the 5th of October 1102, when his son Monica was about 7 years old, was called O'Morgher, or O'Mungher, a name afterwards changed to O'Doherty. The family of O'Morgher, according to the learned Franciscan historian Halgan, is at present represented by the O'Dohertys of the county of Donegal. St. Monica's mother, as St. Bernard says, was more distinguished by the gifts of mind than even by birth. She probably belonged to the family of O'Hanratty, which then possessed the lands of Bangor, under the abbots of that Celtic foundation, co-arts, or successors of St. Condor. It may be surmised that Bangor, though at that period it had largely lost its greatness, still had some type of school of advanced studies to which was attracted from Tyrconnell either as a student or as a professor or teacher, Mungron Umorgir, who there married a daughter of the great noble family, a family which had belonged to the peninsula of the Arts and to some tribe in the neighbourhood of Bangor, but which afterwards moved to Armagh. St. Bernard, in his Life of St. Malachy of Armagh, to which I will make quite a few references, frequent references here tonight, lays great emphasis on the influence of Malachy's mother on the life of her son. At Armagh, her husband, O'Morgar, became what was called chief lector, and it was here that their children, two sons and a daughter, were born. The baptismal name given to the sons indicate the piety of the parents. The elder, Gilara Creosote, or servant of Christ, became diocesan bishop of Clogher in 1135. The younger, Milwiog, Latinized into Malachias, whence it assumes the form more familiar to us of Malachy, was the younger of the two sons. The brothers are described in the calendar of Donegal as of the Kinnell Connell, which seems to confirm the statement of Colgan that the O'Morgars are at present represented, as I have said, by the family called O'Doherty. St. Bernard testifies that their countrymen styled St. Malachy and his brother the two pillars of their church. This was indeed a fine testimony from the greatest churchman in the Europe of his day, St. Bernard. But ladies and gentlemen, before attempting to outline the life and work of St. Malachy here tonight, it is essential, indeed it is necessary, to give some account of that movement which changed the whole face of the Irish Church, and to the advancement of which St. Malachy devoted his life. Now, in default of a better phrase, we might call the movement a 12th century reformation, though it might perhaps be more accurately described as an ecclesiastical revolution. And without some knowledge of its aims and progress, it is quite impossible to assign to Malachy his true place in the history of his native land. The reconstitution of the Irish Church in the 12th century was sponsored by Lanfranc and his successor Anselm, Archbishops of Canterbury, and Gilbert, Bishop of Limerick, and Abbot of Bangor, by the way. The reconstitution of the Irish Church in the 12th century was sponsored by Lanfranc and his successor Anselm, Archbishops of Canterbury, and Gilbert, Bishop of Limerick, and later by the subject of our theme here tonight, Malachy O'Morgar. Gilbert and Malachy were the leaders of what in much later days was called the Ultramontane movement. In the 8th and 9th centuries, Irishmen revolted against the worldliness of the church and formed strict communities. This was because it was struggling against a lawless and savage paganism in the midst of which a Christian life was virtually impossible, except in a community exclusively Christian. Hence the monastic character impressed itself upon Irish Christianity from its first introduction into the island. A Cro-Enobite association, not always rigidly confined to one sex, seemed the natural and almost the only means of obtaining for their inmates all the rights of the church, those which could be administered by priests, and those of which the proper minister was a bishop only. The abbot or superior may have been a presbyter only, or even a layman, or as in the case of St. Bridget of Kildare, and her dependent abbess, even a woman. And Bridget of Kildare, as we know, ruled right arbitrarily. But, having said that, a bishop was always connected with the society, although without diocese or jurisdiction. I would like to emphasize that at this stage very clearly. A bishop was always connected with the society, but without a territorial area, or diocese, or jurisdiction. And he was bound, like the other inmates of the Celtic monastery, to render an absolute obedience to his monastic superior. Did not, for example, in the year 843, as Reeves has reminded us, the jurisdiction of the Abbot of Armagh extended to Kildare, so that there was no diocesan or parochial system. It was non-existent. It is not a little remarkable that many of the monastic churches, which grew in after times to be bishop sees, were formed by presbyters. The great promoters of the conventual system sought no higher order than such as would enable them, consistently with the vows of humility, to administer the sacraments and conduct the ordinary devotions of their fraternities. The abbatial office gave them all the jurisdiction of the episcopate without its responsibilities, and little more was left to the Celtic bishop than the essence of his office, the transmission of holy order, with the personal reverences that were due to the holder of so important a commission. The bishops in the ancient Celtic Church must therefore have been a much more numerous type of ecclesiastic than in later times. And apart from the fact that they, as I have emphasized, possessed no diocesan jurisdiction, they occupied a position not unlike that held by officers of the church who are known today as rural deans, or in the Catholic Church as the vicar of Fife, V.F. Diocesan episcopacy, as now understood, only came, and at first somewhat superficially, as I'll show on maps later, with the Synod of Rathdrasa in 1103. When Malachy was about a teenager. And it was at the Synod of Rathdrasa in 1110 when the Irish Church was reorganized in harmony with the other churches of Western Christendom and along the lines of the pattern set by the North Diocese of Dublin, Waterford and Limerick. Now, the monastic character of the Celtic Church, which was something altogether peculiar to Western Christendom, eventually precluded her from doing her duty. Nor, as Professor Curtis has pointed out, was she enabled to do her duty until she was thoroughly purified, reorganized, and brought into line with the universal church under the discipline of Rome. In the regeneration of society, in religion and morals, the See of Rome in the 11th century, as was natural and right, took the lead. And the price to be paid for the reorganization of Christian society was unity and the recognition of papal authority. The Celtic churches of Ireland, Wales, Scotland and Brittany had not, it is true, ever repudiated Catholic unity, but the connection with headquarters was almost nil, and the monastic character of these churches and their local peculiarities constituted a form of ecclesiastical home rule, which was not heresy or schism, but clearly was not submission or conformity. Now, the Celtic episcopacy was an order first in dignity and distinct from that of presbyter and deacon. The Celtic Church had not yet received or had neglected the Nicene decree that there should be no consecration without the presence of three bishops. Indeed, it was not uncommon that in Ireland a bishop, as in the case of St. Ambrose of Milan, should be taken from the ranks of the laity. A new class of ecclesiastics now arose who desired to remedy local effects by introducing continental practices and ultramontane authority. Two persons, Gilbert of Limerick and Malachy of Down, and both of whom at one time or another occupied the office of Abbot of Bangor, were the principal instruments in adopting the Celtic Church to the advanced continental type, and who deplored their own insular and Celtic irregularities in an Ireland, the world forgetting by the world forgot. Indeed, as the late Dr. R.A.S. McAllister, Professor of Celtic Archaeology at University College in Dublin, has stated, Ireland had too long remained in isolation. Ireland must now, for her own sake, strengthen the bonds that linked her to the rest of the Church in Europe. The monasteries of native growth must now give place to plantings of the great European orders. Synod after synod must sit under direct papal auspices and must bring to an end abuses in ecclesiastical government and in public morality. This process of breaking down the isolation and self-sufficiency which had brought nothing but corruption lasted throughout the 12th century. Did not Pope Alexander III, for example, write the Irish bishops that he had heard from several of them how great are the enormities of vice with which the people of Ireland are infected, and how they have departed from the fear of God and the established practice of the Christian faith, so that their souls have been placed in peril? None felt more than Malachy, whose life was comprehended in the first half of the 12th century, the contrast between the comparative order and civilization abroad and conditions at home. Ecclesiastical rights had fallen into abeyance, immorality was rampant, many abuses such as hereditary abbacies, and not least at Armagh, had become firmly established. So firmly indeed were the people rooted in their ways that a reformer, however zealous he might be, would have stood little chance of success if he had trusted only to his own resources and have neglected to enlist the powerful aid of the Church in the regions beyond the seas. Now, the monastic character of the Celtic Church, which was something altogether peculiar to Western Christendom, eventually precluded her from doing her duty. Nor, as Professor Curtis has pointed out, was she unable to do her duty until she was thoroughly purified, reorganized, and brought into line with the universal Church under the discipline of Rome. In the regeneration of society, in religion and morals, the See of Rome in the 11th century, as was natural and right, took the lead, and the price to be paid for the reorganization of Christian society was unity, and, as I have already said, the recognition of papal authority. The Celtic episcopacy was an order first in dignity and distinct from that, as I have said, of presbyter and deacon. But let enthusiastic Irish antiquaries, ecclesiastical, or otherwise right of the mayor. Celtic church government by the 12th century had become obsolete and unwieldy. It was eminently desirable in the interest, in its own interests, that its organization should be changed and brought into line with that which prevailed in England and on the continent. The numerous bishops had become the mere creatures of the princes, and not the least important feature of Irish ecclesiastical history from the 9th to the 12th century was the decline of the native Irish monasticism. Some decline this, you may well say, from the 6th century until the 9th, when, in the words of the late Professor Arthur Kingsley Porter, Professor of Fine Art in the University of Harvard, Kingsley Porter wrote, from the 6th to the 9th century, Ireland stood at the head of European culture. And is there not the fine tribute of the famous lexicographer Dr. Samuel Johnson, who wrote, Ireland during those centuries was the school of the West, the quiet habitation of sanctity and literature. The reform of, or ecclesiastical revolution in the 12th century Irish church owed much to foreign influence. The popes in the 11th century shook off the protection of the German or Holy Roman emperors, of the Holy Roman Empire, which Voltaire, the French philosopher, described as neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. The popes in the 11th century, I say, shook off the protection of the German or Holy Roman emperors, held synods, and built up a body of reforming cardinals who campaigned against clerical marriage, the purchase of ecclesiastical office, and lay control over church appointments. Pope Gregory VII, for example, pronounced on papal authority and developed a highly centralized and effective papal monarchy. It claimed freedom from secular control and aimed at energetic reformation of the church. Freedom from secular control meant on the continent freedom from the influence of lay lords. In Ireland, it meant breaking the system of kindred and hereditary succession by which some of the great abbacies were held. For instance, Celsus elected abbot of Armagh in 1105, belonged to the seventh generation of a family which had held the abbacy since the year 966. His predecessors were not in major orders and were married. He himself was a layman when he became co-ord, or successor of Patrick and abbot of Armagh. 6 weeks after his election, he abandoned the tradition of a century and a half and received holy orders. A synod at Cashel in 1101 insisted that no layman should be an abbot and that no abbot should have a wife. It tried to stop unsuitable appointments and to tighten the Irish law on marriage. Continental religious orders came to Ireland and often assumed the endowments of the older Celtic monasteries, a course of action that was not done, needless to say, without a certain degree of friction. Gilbert of Limerick might be described as one of the most remarkable Irishmen of his time. He was the contemporary of Malachy and the representative and embodiment of the authority of the Holy See. Gilbert, after he became papal legate, issued the treatise De Statu Ecclesiae, the purpose of which was to set forth the proper organization of the church. Now, the main novel feature to those brought up under the now somewhat discredited Celtic system was that bishops should be the principal rulers of the church, including the monasteries, not the abbots, as heretofore. Obviously, if this scheme was to be adopted in Ireland, great changes would have to be enforced. Gilbert describes the laity as of two classes, husbandmen and soldiers. The duties of the laity, metaphorically speaking, cut it up with a jigsaw into 24 portions called dioceses. I'll show you a map of that at the end of this talk. Now, each diocese was to be under the jurisdiction of a bishop, who should have a cathedral or pontifical church as his sede or seat. It made a primary effort to map Ireland into dioceses in accordance with the Roman church system. It is important to note now the difference between a see and a diocese, and a great many people seem to confuse the two. Even the learned Reeves, for example, followed by no less a person than Monsignor O'Laverty in his Down and Connor, writing of the origin of the diocese, they actually say that small Celtic seas, such for example as Nendra in County Down, or the Sea of Armagh in County Antrim, that these, where occasionally bishops had seas, were eventually swallowed into one large diocese, that of Down and Connor. But you can't possibly join a number of bishop seats, either temporary or permanent, to make a territorial area. Ireland then was to be divided into two ecclesiastical portions. The northern, or Leith Cluain, with its headquarters at Armagh, and the southern, Leith Voga, with its headquarters at Cashel. This arrangement was, as the historian Geoffrey Keating expressly says, modelled upon a similar reorganisation of the Anglo-Saxon Church carried through nearly half a century previously in England after the Norman invasion of that country. It is usual to designate the boundaries of the various dioceses by four or more places and in a clockwise direction in accordance with medieval custom. Gilbert was determined that whatever the fate of the other diocese, the bounds of his own diocese of Limerick should not be called in question. Not only were 13 places named as boundaries of his diocese of Limerick, but language much more forceful than that contained in Deuteronomy chapter 27 verse 17, and you can look those verses up for yourself if you like. Language much stronger than that contained in Deuteronomy was invoked against anyone who might presume to alter Gilbert's boundaries of the diocese of Limerick. And Gilbert says, "Whosoever transgresses these boundaries does so in contempt of the Lord." And the Apostle Peter and St. Patrick and his successor under the Christian Church. There was much to be done before the new diocesan arrangements could become effective. You can see the problem. It can well be conceived that the Celtic bishops and abbots would be slow to submit themselves to the new diocesan order. And as a matter of fact, although the dioceses were delineated in 1110, the appointments of the new diocesan bishops to fill them was destined to be a somewhat gradual process. Take, for instance, the case in the Diocese of Clogher. Clogher became a diocesan see. What were you going to do with the Abbot of Devenish? The Celtic Abbot of Devenish, felt himself a far, far more important person than any Bishop of Clogher. What were you to do with him under these changes? Well, they decided on a plan whereby the Abbot of Devenish was regarded as not good enough for heaven to be a bishop and not bad enough for the other place, and so he became prebendary of Devenish in the cathedral. He got up the bend of stall, and that's how they, as it were, shut his mouth. Now, thus it was that shortly before Celsus of Armagh, co-orb of Patrick, died in 1129, he named the reforming Malachy as his successor. It happened that Celsus fell sick. He it was, says St. Bernard, who ordained Malik a deacon, presbyter, and bishop. And knowing that he was dying, Celsus made a sort of testament to the effect that Maliki ought to succeed him, because none seemed worthier to be bishop of the first see. Celsus, like Maliki himself, was one of the leaders of the Romanizing party in Ireland, and was present at the Synod of Rathbrassel. His eight predecessors, co-orbs of Patrick at Armagh, St. Bernard informs us, were married men and without orders, albeit men of letters. With such a line of predecessors, small wonder that Celsus became an ardent advocate of reform. At the time of the Synod of Rathbrassel, Maliki was about 16 years of age and passed under the care of a very remarkable man, a hermit or recluse called Ivar or Imar O'Hagan. O'Hagan founded the monastery of Saints Peter and Paul inside the Rath at Armagh. It occupied approximately the garden of the present church house in that city. Maliki was old enough to choose his own teachers and acknowledged O'Hagan as his master. O'Hagan died in 1134 in the course of a pilgrimage to Rome. Celsus and Imar were desirous of promoting Maliki to holy orders, and so, in 1119, though he had not yet reached canonical age, Maliki was admitted by Celsus to the order of deacon. Immediately afterwards, Celsus appointed his vicar and committed to him the charge of correcting many abuses which have grown up in the diocese. The diocese. We can speak of a diocese now, because it's after 1110. St. Bernard gives us a vivid and precise picture of Maliki's reforming activity in his early spell of diocesan administration in Armagh from 1119 to 1121. In all churches, says St. Bernard, Maliki ordained the apostolic sanctions and the decrees of the Holy Fathers, and especially the customs of the Holy Roman Church. Hence it is to this day that there is chanting and psalmody in them at the canonical hours, after the fashion of the whole world. For there was no such thing before, not even in the city of Armagh. He, however, had himself learned to sing in his youth, and soon he introduced song into his monastery, while as yet no one in the city nor in the whole diocese either could or would sing. Then Maliki instituted anew the most wholesome usage of confession, the sacrament of confirmation, the contract of marriage, all of which were either all known to the people or neglected by them. Throughout his life, Maliki's personal preference was for the cloister, and his career was to be as much connected with monasticism as with the episcopate. He held the abbacy of Bangor as co-orb of St. Comgall from 1120 until his death in 1148. From 1122 to 1124, he was at the monastery at Lismore, what is now County Waterford, then under Malchus, a Benedictine monk of Winchester, consecrated by Anselm, Archbishop of Canterbury, as the first Bishop of Waterford. Lismore was a major centre of Irish ecclesiastical reform. In 1124, Maliki was recalled to the north by his friend Celsus to become first diocesan, Bishop of Connacht. His choice was natural and suitable. Maliki was, through his mother, as I stated at the outset, of the founder's kin of Comgall of Bangor. His uncle, Murto O'Hanratty, being co-orb and apparently lay abbot, Murto, as under the prevalent custom he had a right to do, handed over the co-orbship and possessions attached to Bangor Abbey to Maliki, becoming apparently an ordinary inmate under him. Maliki retained his office as abbot of Bangor, which he held with that of Bishop of Connor, which then included Down and Ivy or Drumore, as I will show on the maps later. To the Irish of that age, the successor or co-orb of St. Comble in the Abbacy of Bangor was a far more important person than any diocesan bishop, and in any event, Malachy had an almost hereditary right to the Abbacy of Bangor. Malachy made Bangor his see, or seat, of the diocese, and appointed a chapter of canons regular of St. Augustine, who were given the power of election of his successors. And as an integral part of the reconstitution of the church, various religious orders were introduced to fill the place of the Celtic monks whose system had broken down. The earliest of these were the canons regular of St. Augustine introduced into Armagh in 1126. Augustinian canons, for the most part, took the place of the monks of the ancient Celtic Church. But why, you may ask, Augustinians? Why the Augustinian order? The simple answer is that Augustinian canons were the only order of regular clerics recognized at this period by the Roman Church. But that was not all. An Augustinian chapter, as Malachy well realized, would be specially suitable in the early stages of the formation of a diocese such as Connor, in a country which was experiencing the vast change from monastic to diocesan episcopacy. Most persons who have studied the organization and methods of an Augustinian community have been impressed by its capacity as an instrument of spiritual administration. For example, you have much the same phenomenon at Carlisle, which was the last bishopric to be founded in England before the 16th century or Protestant Reformation. The ancient priory at Carlisle was one of Augustinian canons, and when the diocese was established by King Henry I, after the disaster of the White Ship, the king appointed as bishop Athelwold, the prior of the Augustinian priory. And the interesting thing is that to this day, to this very day at Carlisle, in the Church of England, the bishop is not only enthroned in the episcopal throne in the cathedral, but he is also installed in what is called the prior's stall on the episcopal side, and directly opposite the dean's stall on the gospel side. It is important to note that until 1244, Bangor was the see town of the Diocese of Down. It was not until that year that Downpatrick became the see town of the diocese, its Benedictine monastery being the cathedral, and its monks constituting, as it were, a chapter. Bangor had been a great centre of religious life in the days of monastic episcopacy. The early Celtic Church had its own liturgical peculiarities, as is evident from the Antiphonarium Bangorense, or Antiphonary of Bangor, a 7th century Irish prayer book, the original copy of which is now in Milan. In that book, we find a creed used at Bangor, which differs in form from every other creed hitherto known. The Celtic monks enclosed the ground they chose for a religious foundation, such as Bangor, with a cashel or rampart, usually made of earth or loose stones, somewhat after the manner, for example, of the cashel in the townland of Altagore, the height of the goat, a short distance northwest of Turnamoney Bridge on the coast road to Ballycastle, and 1 mile north of where we are sitting. I do not suggest, however, that the cashel at Altagore, or like the cashel or rampart of Bangor, was necessarily ecclesiastical in origin. The church and eating house or refectory and the outer buildings at Bangor were chiefly of wood. Each cell was either a hut of wattles or a circular building of rough stones, beehive in shape, such as may be seen today in Skellig Michael off the coast of County Kerry. These cells, in which the monks spent much of their time, chiefly in writing, stood in a little court. All things were held in common, and a monk had absolutely nothing of his own. In 1137, Malachy established such a church of stone and mortar on the old site. It was a classic building, St. Bernard assures us, previously unknown in the country. This, however, is a mistake on the part of Bernard, though it might mean no more than that the former church of Wattle and Dob had fallen into decay. St. Bernard informs us, it seemed good to Malachy that a stone oratory should be erected at Bangor, like those which he had seen constructed in other regions. And when he began to lay the foundations, the natives wondered, because in that land, that is the district around Bangor, no such buildings were yet to be found. This structure was a great oratory of stone and very beautiful. Malachy's new church in the sea town of his diocese was therefore, from its erection until the middle of the 13th century, the diocesan cathedral of Down. Despite the circumstance that Malachy placed in his new monastery a convent of regular canons of St. Augustine, it never became as such an important establishment. Indeed, by 1469, the place was derelict, and a community of the Third Order of St. Francis, tertiary Franciscans, as at Bonamargue, near Ballycastle, founded in 1500, have settled in Malachy's foundation at Bangor. The abbey was situated in the grounds of what now constitutes the Abbey Church of Bangor, a modern erection built on the site of an older one put up by Sir James Hamilton, the lay rector, in the early 17th century. And of the ecclesiastical buildings erected by Malachy at Bangor, it is pretty safe to say that not one stone now stands upon another. Malachy's Diocese of Connor, as defined by the fathers of Ralph Brassel, extended from Benevena, what is now County Derry, to Torhead, and from Merlith Bay to Loch, and to Carlingford Loch, and from the Neary River to Slieve Galliot. This was a very substantial area, and was known as the Diocese of Connor, as I will show in the maps. I prefer not to use them. I want to get through this first of all. Malachy's earnest, vigorous labours among the mountains and glens of Antrim must have constituted an epoch in the history of the diocese, and shed a halo of piety and devotion round his efforts for the reformation of the Celtic Church. It should be noted here in Cushion Dun, in the Grange of Inniscollum, is the only site of an ancient Celtic church in the diocese, as O'Laverty reminds us, which is occupied by a modern Catholic church in the townland of Ardacoa. So you see, generations of the faithful in this part of the glens have heard the small bell ring of the sacrifice of the Mass long before the Episcopate of Malachy, patron saint of the diocese. As a bishop, Malachy devoted himself to his work. His activity was ceaseless and his self-denial extreme. St. Bernard describes him in one place as perpetually traversing towns and villages on foot, preaching the gospel and attended only by some chosen disciples. In another place, he thus sets forth the simplicity of his life and the fervour of his piety. He had neither servants, nor estates, nor revenues. His episcopal table possessed no money for its support. He had not even a house of his own. He was incessantly visiting his parishes, serving the gospel and living by the gospel, as the Lord had appointed, saying, "The workman is worthy of his hire." Poverty seemed indeed to have been Malachy's voluntary choice, though some Irish bishops were compelled to accept it nolentes volentes. In the 16th century, the ancient bishopric or see of Annaghdown in County Galway was worth only £20 a year, and at the Third Lateran Council, Pope Alexander III discovered an Irish bishop whose income consisted of the milk of 3 cows. And when they went dry, his people supplied him with 3 other cows. We hear something today of clerical exorcism. And Maniche was something of a 12th century exorcist. St. Bernard tells us in these lines, and these are his words translated, there was a woman in Coleraine who had a demon. Maniche was called, he prayed for the possessed, he commanded the invader, and he went out. But his iniquity was not yet fully satisfied, and he entered into an unhappy woman who happened to be standing by. And Maliki said, I did not release that woman from your grasp in order that you might enter this one. Go out of her also. He obeyed, but went back to the former woman, and driven forth from her once more, he again went into the second. So for some time he vexed them alternately, fleeing to and fro. Then the saint, indignant that he was mocked by the demon, summoned up his spirit and shouted, and when he had made an attack on the adversary with all the forces of fate, he drove the demon away from both, no less vexed than those whom he had vexed. But do not suppose, reader, that the delay which he caused the saint was due to his own strength. It was permitted by the divine dispensation, evidently in order that by this as well the power of the evil one as the victory of Maliki might be made more manifest. And I sometimes wonder, could that episode in the episcopate of Maliki be a reason why the chapel in Coleraine is dedicated under his invocation? Maliki's account of religion and morals in Eastern Ulster, of which Bangor was the central point in his extensive diocese, is highly unflattering to our spiritual forebears. Indeed, as recounted by St. Bernard, it could hardly be more depressing. As a matter of fact, in 1127, but 3 years after his appointment, he was driven out of Bangor by Conor O'Loughlin and once again betook himself with his community to Moffat at Lismore. When he began to administer his office, says St. Bernard, as Bishop of Conor, the man of God, that is Maliki, that's how Bernard refers to him, Maliki understood that he had been sent not to men but to beasts. Never before had he known the like in whatever depth of barbarism. Never had he found men so shameless in their morals, so wild in their rites, so impious in their faith, so barbarous in their laws, so stubborn in discipline, so unclean in their life. They were Christians in name, in fact, they were pagans. They did not give first fruits or tithes. They did not enter unlawful marriage. They made no confessions. Nowhere was there to be found any who might either seek or impose penance. Ministers of the altar were few indeed. But what need was there of war when even the few lived idle lives among the laity? They had no prospect of fruitful work in their office among so wicked a people. In the churches was heard neither the voice of a preacher nor of a singer. What was the athlete of the Lord to do? Asks Bernard. Maliki worked incessantly to effect a reformation in faith and morals, and apparently with excellent results. St. Bernard now presents the other side of the picture. Barbarous laws disappeared, Roman laws were introduced, everywhere ecclesiastical customs were received and the contrary rejected. Churches were rebuilt and the clergy appointed to them. The sacraments were duly solemnized and confessions were made. The people came to the church and those who were living in concubinage were united in lawful wedlock. In short, all things were so changed that the word of the Lord may today be applied to this people, which before was not my people, now is my people. We can detect the language of exaggeration in the account of this rapid reformation. Both St. Malachy and St. Bernard were horrified at the absence of the special features of Roman Church life. But there is no doubt whatever that Irish marriage customs were extremely lax. Temporary marriage and concubinage were prevalent, and at least in the field of sexual morals, Roman influences introduced genuine reforms. Moreover, after making allowance for Malachy's prejudices, it is impossible entirely to ignore his testimony to the spiritual impoverishment of northeastern Ireland. The diocese have suffered very severely from the Norsemen, and during the century after their departure, it was ravaged by prolonged civil war. Corruptio optimi pessima. The corruption of the best is worst of all. But higher promotion than the bishopric of Connor still awaited Malachy. Cases of Armagh, a prelate somewhat wanting in backbone, which is one of the first qualities desirable in a bishop or archbishop, he must have backbone, Celsus had fixed upon Malachy as the only one fitted to destroy the power and influence of the clique, which for well over two centuries had controlled the see of Armagh. There had been a bishop of Armagh at the end of that century, whose preceding years had seen the deaths of St. Ambrose, St. Chrysostom, St. Augustine, and St. Jerome. Is not this wonderful continuity with the past an awe-inspiring thing? And so Celsus chose Malachy as his successor and sent him his pastoral staff as token of his choice. But Malachy was prudent, as well as zealous. He knew the difficulties of the task and the danger to be incurred at the hands of the dominant faction in Armagh. For the Irish of that day, says Professor Stokes, writing in 1888, would have thought as little of murdering an unpopular primate as a Kerry Moonlighter today thinks of shooting an unpopular landlord. Malachy declined to accept the primacy till formally elected at a national synod, convoked about 1134 by Gilbert of Limerick, the papal legate, and attended by princes of the whole island. And armed now with the full power of church and state, Malachy proceeded to execute his mission, in which he was eminently successful. But Malachy had no mind to spend the rest of his life at Armagh. He had stipulated that as soon as he had been accepted as high bishop, rather than archbishop, which didn't really come until somewhat later. The term high bishop was the Celtic term. Archbishop was more the term used after Ralph Russell, but didn't come into effect just immediately. And Malachy, although he, as soon as he had been accepted as high bishop of Armagh, he should resign the see and return to his beloved Bangor, as he called it. Malachy would only use peaceful means to attain his ends, and rather than be engaged in conflict with the Celtic tradition, which still lingered on in Armagh, which was very much inter-Hibernicos, he resigned the successorship of Patrick, as the annals of the Four Masters express it, for the sake of God. So, in 1137 he nominated and consecrated Gerasius as a successor in the high bishopric of Armagh, and returned as bishop of the newly constituted diocese of Down, or as St. Bernard puts it, to his former see, but not to Connor. Now let me explain this somewhat puzzling statement. Malachy had some years' experience of the people of the diocese of Connor, whom St. Bernard described as not men but beasts. Malachy had doubtless discovered that the vast area which it included, from Benevena to Newry, as I said and as I'll show in a map later, Malachy had doubtless discovered that this vast area which intruded, the vast area which it intruded, could not be ruled by a single bishop. In fact, it consisted of two tribal territories with strong sectional antipathies, which characterized the Dalaradians of Connor and the Ulidians of Down. Europe was a district which intruded the greater part of the present county of Down and the southern part of Antrim. Diocesan boundaries must coincide with racial divisions, and thus originated the present diocese of Down and Connor. Down was a separate diocese in 1137 and was not reunited with Connor until 1451 by Pope Eugene